The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Sports Talk 1240 is brought to you by DraftPot.com. DraftPot is changing fantasy sports. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with promo code SportsTalk1240 and receive a 100% deposit bonus up to $1,500. And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, folks, welcome in Sunday night, Sports Talk 1240. And you're with the Wise, Derek Wisiak. And across the way, John Panarese, big Met fan, filling in for Sweeney Dog. But before we get to baseball and the playoffs and hockey, with the regular season starting up, we're going to focus on a little NFL. We got a special guest tonight, Bob Crable, former Jet from the early 80s. And that's right, folks, it's a Jet start to the show, because the Jets are 3-1, heading into their bye week. Big win today against arch rival Miami. But not locally. Not in New York. Not down in sunny Miami. Across the sea in London. NFL been doing that for about 10 years. And the Jets went across seas to London. And the score was not indicative of what went on in this game. What was indicative was the Jets running the ball down Miami's throat. Chris Ivory had a hell of a game. 29 carries for .168, the touchdown. And Brandon Marshall had a good game. But the Jets defense, at one point, had Miami 0-16 combined on third down and fourth down conversions. And that was basically the story. The only thing that kept this score close was the penalties. The Jets did take a lot of penalties once again. And that was about it. They basically got a touchdown off of that. And I got to be honest with you, I'm not surprised by what the Jets are doing. Todd Bowles doing a hell of a job running his defense. Fitzpatrick, the quarterback, is running things efficiently. And the Jets have taken three of their first four games. And we'll get into, you know, what's gone on in the first quarter of this NFL season a little later on. But as I stated at the start of the show, we got a special guest tonight. And he played for the Jets during the heyday of the sack exchange. From 1982 to 1987, he patrolled linebacker. He wore number 50, and his name was Bob Crable. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you coming on. I'm here. My name's Derek Wisiak. Across the way from me is John Panarese. And Bob, folks might not know this, but Bob Crable, not only linebacker for the Jets in the early 80s, but also a two-time All-American at Notre Dame University. Now, Bob, I know you grew up where football was born, in Ohio. So, so I like to profile my guests when they come on the show, and not a lot of diehard Jet fans have seen or heard from you in years, and I'm sure they love to catch up with you. So, you know, they're familiar with the early 80s and some of the ups and downs with the Jets and watching you play linebacker alongside Lance Mell and guys like Greg Buddle and Kyle Clifton. But let's go back to when you're born in Cincinnati, Ohio. You grow up as a young athlete. Obviously, football is your game. But as a kid in Ohio, were there any other sports you played besides football?
Yeah, I played them all, Derek. I played, the big three, you know, basketball, baseball. My older brother, I came from a family of seven kids. So my older brother, who was about 4 years older than I was, we would compete constantly. And he was a very good basketball player, which I developed unfortunately, or fortunately, I'm not sure, a mentality that, I could never let anyone beat me. And not only did he beat me at basketball, and when I was a kid, beat me at basketball, baseball, football, and then he beat me because I would probably usually start a fight with him because he did beat me. So I certainly give him some of the credit to my toughness over the years. He's a great guy, and like I said, he probably is the one who is more responsible for performing some of my competitiveness as well as some of my skills.
You know, Bob, I'd like to ask about a kid's youth in terms of the sports he played, because, you know, a lot of times today, the parents with the kids, they isolate on one sport. And I was always a big believer, having coached, and I know you coached after your playing days also. I was always a big believer in kids playing multiple sports, just because different sports develop the different muscles in the body. And kids right. need that at a young age, because you're not really lifting weights till you get to a more advanced junior high school level. How did you feel about that, being a coach at the high school level?
Well, I'll tell you what, Derek. Probably one of the more significant issues within our culture, I believe, is, you know, when we were kids, hey, you know, your mom and dad, or, you know, in my case, my mom, you know, say, hey, get out of the house and go outside and play.
That's it.
And not only did you go out and play, but you also had to organize a game. You had to, you know, at different times. You know, there was some conflict resolution involved in it. You know, you fought, you made up, you kept playing. You know, sometimes you went home, you know, you told your mom what happened, she said, get out of my face. You know, when I was coaching, and I coached at Moeller from 1992 through 2008, and I had, oh my goodness, you know, mostly, I've got to tell you, mostly mothers would come to me and, you know, they would take you out, man. You know, my son's not getting enough playing time. And I started with a policy when I became the head coach in 2001. I started with a policy of, hey, we don't talk about playing time. You want to come in and talk about, you know, issues that your son has? Absolutely. I'm there, you know, like, let's get these things worked out and make him, you know, a better young man. So, and I'll tell you, 9 out of 10 times, just, hey, I've got to talk to you about this issue my son had. Meet him after practice, and it always got around to playing time, you know. And especially the Catholic high school where we were, you know, where I was teaching, you know, there was a $10,000 tuition bill.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of these people thought, hey, this $10,000 I'm paying for high school, you know, translates into him getting a scholarship. And some of them just didn't have the ability to get a, you know, not only not to get a scholarship, but to get on the football field a lot of times.
No, you're right, Bob. I think I had it a little easier than you coaching, one, because I was an assistant coach, and secondly, because I was a police officer. So I wasn't at the school. I came in to coach, and when practice of the game was over, I left. And, you know, I would tell kids, you know, I'll talk to you about your playing time and your position on the depth chart and all that. But I think the head coach, you know, he had to deal with the parents a lot more than me. I think one time a parent wanted to talk to me about something involving their kid, and when I walked in the office, like, all the other coaches looked up because they knew I wasn't going to really stay in the room for too long. So I think I can relate. I understand what you went through. But I guess a lucky thing for me is I didn't have to go through that. But for the most part, parents were good. But I know exactly where you're coming from. And I was like you growing up also. The only thing my mom cared about is that I was home on time for dinner. But I was out of the house.
That's it. That's it. Just get home in time for dinner. And you know, but get out of the house. Get, you know, the video games and everything else. They just, it's all indoors now.
Right. Well, I was actually up in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We came back today, and my son's actually at Grand Valley State, and he's a quarterback up there. But these guys, I'm telling you, they'll sit around their dorm room, and they'll play video games for hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you try to do is say, okay, hey, look at who are you keying on this, you know, who are you keying on this game? Who are you keying on this play? You try to create some type of a game out of it where they actually have to use their mind.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you, my son, when he was in high school, my youngest son, I should say, the ones at Grand Valley State,
right.
He and his buddies, he had a core of 3 or 4 buddies, and they would come over here, and they would go downstairs, and they would play the video games, but they would hoot and holler and carry on and laugh, and and all the things that you look that you want your kids to do with their buddies.
Right.
You know, and that's, if you can get that done where they're developing those real bonds and friendships, you know, you got something special, I think.
You know, I did notice from watching College Game Day on ESPN yesterday, some of the coaches are using techniques that involve the addiction some of these kids have to video games. I saw a piece on Stanford University, and they were using, like, the vision goggles with the quarterback so we could read the blitz and then find the hot receiver and all that. And so I think some coaches are trying to adapt to just the way society has evolved and how the athlete has changed over the decades. So
Derek, I'll tell you what. One of my issues, I think, really revolved when I was the head coach. One of my issues was, hey, this is the way I was coached. You know, I'm gonna be a if you'll pardon the expression, a hard ass, and I'm gonna, you know, deal with kids. They're gonna develop some mental toughness.
Right.
And that was always a mindset. I would go to parents before every season. I'd say, you know, we're trying to develop mental toughness with your kids, and I wouldn't get kids not coming out for the football team because they didn't want that. You know, really, you got to applaud, and this is what I learned about my coaching experience, is you got to meet them where they're at.
Right.
You can't expect for them to meet you where you're at, and the good coaches are able to do that.
Yeah, you adapt. You're trying to develop athletes and get the most out of them for themselves. So now, when you're growing up as a young kid, young athlete, who were some of your favorite sports teams that you followed in baseball or football?
Well, you know, the Reds. That was back when the big red machine was hot and heavy.
Right.
You know, you always that was the one that was near and dear.
Okay.
You know, football wise, I was a big Steeler fan.
All right.
You know, and I can't say that too loud. I can't say that too loud in Cincinnati because there's so much hatred there.
Yeah, they'll get upset.
Their defense. Oh my goodness! You know, I love watching their defense and love they were an intimidating group of guys that got after people. And Jack Lambert,
right.
Jack Ham, and Andy Russell. Those guys were. Oh, they were the men as far as I was concerned growing up.
Was any one of those your favorite football player growing up at all, or was it somebody from a little further back?
It was Lambert, absolutely.
Lambert, okay.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I went to my mom at one point and I said, Mom, what do you think would happen if I knocked my two front teeth out?
Right. Because the poster was great, right? With his grin and missing teeth.
God. She looked at me and she said, We spent $2,000 on your mouth, son, with braces. You knock your teeth out, and I'm going to knock your head off.
Right.
So she's a great one.
Yeah, and the whole steel curtain defense, and you got to play for Bud Carson later on with the Jets. But yeah, those linebackers, they were something else to watch on the football field.
And you know, one of the great things was playing with Bud and having that affinity towards the Steelers when he was coaching them. He had stories, you know, he had stories about Lambert, he had stories about Bradshaw, and he would tell those stories. We would just laugh.
Right.
We would, because Bud was an ex-Marine who, you know what, he wasn't going to take anything. You know, he and one of the stories he actually told about Lambert was Bud would signal plays in. When he signaled things in, he'd get confused sometimes. So we always had something called automatic. And all he would do is point his finger at you, and we would have a package, a defensive package, where we would make a call based on the formation. So, you know, if he got confused with one side being fronts and one side being coverages, and he just point his finger at you, and you knew what to call. You know, it was easy at that point.
Right.
Well, in this one game, he was doing that, and Lambert got mad because he wasn't getting the signal in fast enough and calls a timeout. And Bud meets him out about the hash mark, and he says, paraphrase, Okay, you embarrass me on national TV, and I will rip your throat out, buddy. And he said Lambert continued to walk past him and get a drink of water, and they talked, and they got everything straightened out. So Bud was a great one. I love Bud. And I think all the guys that played for him loved him.
That's good, because we're going to get to talking about him when we get to your Jet years. But before we get to your high school football and the college, in baseball, since you brought up the Reds, was there anybody that was your all-time favorite Red watching them?
You know what? You got, at the time, certainly Pete Rose. Rose was, a Cincinnati kid, was, that was someone who my dad, he was the blue collar. I grew up in a blue collar family, and he was the guy that I think everyone looked at. I was an infielder, so, I wanted to look at Davey Concepcion, yep. Tony Perez, Johnny Bench, all those guys were, most of those guys are in the Hall of Fame right now.
Oh, yeah.
So, it was always, you always had someone that you could kind of hang your hat on.
All right, so when you went to high school, you went to a famous high school out in Ohio, right? Art Bishop Moeller High School. Yep. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? And, you played for a team that won, as I recall from looking at your bio, 3 state titles in a row and a famous coach that you saw in college at Notre Dame. So why don't you talk about that a little bit and tell the folks what went on in those years?
Well, we had, when I was he was a unique guy. Jerry Faust was a very unique guy because, the neat thing about him was, and there's a lot of people that dislike Jerry, but one of the neat things about him was he made people feel like they belong to the football program at Moeller High School. And he was in a position where he would invite students, he would invite parents, he would invite people that he never even knew into this program, and it was always a, you always had new people coming in and out. But when I was in junior high, he was in charge of recruiting, not just for the football program, but for the entire school.
Okay.
So he would go to all the grade schools and talk to kids, And he was very, he was very convincing. So I wound up, having the opportunity to go to Moeller High School. And they want to move me to offensive line after my freshman year. And he comes and he sees me and he says, hey, Craig, we want to move you to offensive line. What do you think? They want to move me to center.
Right.
And I said, Coach, I'd rather die than play offense.
Right.
And he looks at me and says, are you serious? I said, Coach, I don't like people who play offense. I don't like anything about offense. And I almost went as far as saying I don't even like people who coach offense. So I didn't, because he was an offensive coach.
Right.
So they wound up leaving me on the defensive side of the ball. And, we had some great teams. We were actually the first class to go through Moeller undefeated.
Right.
We our freshman year was an undefeated team. Actually, sophomore year, we tied one. I was on the varsity that year, but we won 3 state championships while I was playing. 36-0. It was a great run. Great people involved. And you find out that, the team, especially on the football field, the team was the way that things, went. That's how you had success. And everyone had a job and everyone took care of each other. And it was a lot of fun during those years.
Any famous teammates at Archbishop Moeller that you played with that went on to big-time pro careers?
Yeah, I played with a gentleman by the name of Tony Hunter. Played with him at Notre Dame as well.
Okay.
He was a split end there. He wound up going to the Bills as a first-round draft choice with the Bills. Played tight end. I think he made it 3 or 4 years. But we had, let's see, Billy Long, one of my classmates, Billy Long, played baseball, actually played with the Cubs and the White Sox.
Okay.
So he had a great career with them. Matter of fact, I think he made it 12 or 14 years in the bigs. And, we wound up with some people who, mostly from a college standpoint, trying to think of some of the guys that made, more the younger guys, made it to the pros after we, we always think we paved the way.
Right.
But, we had a few guys that came in after us.
Right. Now you went to Notre Dame University, right? So you go from Catholic, prestigious Catholic high school to the prestigious
right.
Catholic University, playing at Notre Dame. Your freshman year, you play with Joe Montana, his last year in college. Talk about your freshman year. Talk about the bowl game against Houston, that big Cotton Bowl game.
Yeah. Well, a couple things. Joe is, I was a freshman. He was a fifth-year senior. The neat thing about Joe Montana is, as a freshman, you don't even think you're supposed to be able to say hi to this guy. He's God and everything else. They just came off the national championship the year before, and he had a lot to do with that. But Joe was such a down-to-earth guy. Joe would, talk to us as freshmen. He always impressed me as one of the things that you love to see out of people who have success on the athletic field. You love to be able to know that they're down there, that they are normal people, and Joe was one of those guys. And I know there's some people out there that Joe got cocky the older he got, and this and that. I never had experienced that, and from all my experiences, great guy. The story you're talking about was Houston. Houston game. Oh my goodness, we have sleet and snow in Dallas for the Cotton Bowl, and it goes all night long. And on our way to the game, we're taking a bus on the way to the game, and I'm telling you, we see maybe a dozen cars on the road from our hotel to the stadium. It's cold, it's wet, it's slippery, it's nasty, and we get out, and we're warming up, and we get, wet, and it's just crazy. So, Joe plays part of the first half, and he develops, whether it be, flu symptoms, he's got the shivers, he's got the shakes, and so we go in at halftime, and literally they're feeding Joe chicken noodle soup. And it's to make a long story short, he comes back out and we're down. I think we were down 34-7 maybe, and we come back and miraculously somehow get a 35-34 victory out of the deal.
Wow.
So and he was the reason. I mean, I shouldn't say it. Obviously it's a team,
right?
But Joe's leadership had a lot to do with that. And when Joe was on the football field, people believed a little bit more strongly than when Joe was not on the football field. And even afterwards, Rusty might have been, probably was a better athlete than Joe Montana was. But Rusty had, Rusty didn't have what Joe had. And whether you look at the national championship, whether you look at, what he did when he was with the 49ers,
right.
Joe just had something unique about himself.
Yeah.
And people believed in him, and people wanted to play for him, and, it was, like I said, it was very unique. Great experience.
Yeah, not just a great quarterback, but a leader by example, and he brought out the best in his teammates just probably because of the way he was with them, his whole manner, the way he carried himself. And guys probably, like you said, you enjoyed the fact that as a freshman he would speak with you, right?
Absolutely.
So now the other bowl game you played in, two-time All-American, but you played in the Sugar Bowl Yes. In 1980 against Georgia when they won their big title with Herschel Walker as a true freshman. Right. Can you speak about what it was like playing against Herschel, and was he the toughest running back you went against in college?
Well, he was probably the most well – in college, yes. He was the most well-rounded, the strongest. I'd played against George Rogers the year before. You know, and George was pretty tough, too. I played against Marcus Allen.
Yeah.
And we played against some pretty good players. Herschel certainly was up there in the top, no doubt about that. But he was – the thing that made him – he had such great balance, a great center of gravity. I hit him in different places. Hit him in the thighs. I hit him in the knees. I hit him in the, up in the shoulders, and got him down. Had some success. The one I think that they show a lot on ESPN when we played them was we went nose to nose. I had an opportunity where I came in and I don't remember whether it was a blitz or not, but he was running the football and the ball just got handed to him.
Right.
And we had a collision of monumental proportion.
Right.
And I'll tell you what I remember. I remember hitting and just thinking, oh, man, this guy is on his back. And I look, and he's backing up. Literally, I hit him, and he backs up. He keeps his balance. And I remember thinking to myself, you son of a buck. I got to go. Now I got to go tackle you again. I'm thinking, that's crazy. So he had 130 yards in the first half.
Right.
And they were up, I think they were up 17-3 at halftime. And we couldn't come back. And they beat us 17-10. But he's a freak.
He is. Yeah. That whole thing with his push-ups and sit-ups and the type of workouts he ever did. I asked about him because, we alluded to how it was growing up as a kid, and you're like, you weren't home till dark. But also as a kid, right. I mean, you didn't have 30 different media outlets, Fox Sports 1, ESPN 3, you lived on local sports coverage, and we had baseball cards, and we had Sports Illustrated in. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, here's a true freshman, dominant at Georgia, and he's the only guy I know of that was All-American consensus and top three in the Heisman voting each of his first 3 years.
Absolutely.
In fact,
And then he left there. He didn't ever graduate, did he?
He left after his junior year. Long time, he was still in the top 10 all-time college rushing, despite only having 3 years in college football until a number of younger guys, finally filled out the list. But he's still like 11th or 12th or whatever it is. But, he had to go back. He left and went to the USFL. He cashed in with, Donald Trump and played for Walt Michaels and everything. So that's why I wanted to ask about him.
And also, the one word to describe him has to be free.
He is
simply a he's an anomaly when it comes to athletes.
Right.
And I look at there's some other ones. Bo Jackson, I can't even imagine someone, being able to play baseball at least at the high school level and playing against some awfully good competition.
Right.
To play baseball at the highest level and football at the highest level at the same time, in the same year, that blows me away.
I'll tell you what, Bob, we just have to take a quick station break. Can you stay with us past the break?
Absolutely.
All right, and when we come back, I want to ask you about a famous All-American you play with at Notre Dame, Dave Duerson from the famous 85 Bears defense. So gather some thoughts and maybe stories about Dave, because I thought he was a phenomenal defensive back, both in the college and especially in the pros. And folks, that's what we're going to talk about when we come back with Bob Crable, good old number 50, the early 80s Jets sack exchange defense. We'll be back in a few minutes with Bob.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB. Be sure and visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Hey, fantasy sports fans. DraftPot has an exclusive offer for Sports Talk 1240 listeners. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. That's right. Sign up today at DraftPot.com with the promo code SportsTalk1240, and DraftPot will match 100% of your first deposit up to $1,500. What are you waiting for? Do it now.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Whether you're a couple enjoying a romantic meal for two, a family wanting to dine in a relaxed and friendly setting, or a larger party wanting to celebrate a special occasion, Miller Place Pastoria always combines a warm welcome with the finest contemporary Italian cuisine and wines, also serving up Long Island's favorite pizza. We're located right on Route 25A in Miller Place. Come visit us today and check us out online at mppastoria.com.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, you're back with Derek Wasiak and John Panarese. Happy that Bob Crable has taken the time to spend with us tonight. He's still with us. And we didn't even get to the Jets yet. We're still on Notre Dame. But I wanted to talk to you, Bob, about another guy who was All-American alongside you in 1981, your last year at Notre Dame. And that's Dave Duerson, who is a famous hard-hitting safety in the NFL also of the famous 85 Bears. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what it was like playing in college with Dave.
Well, Dave, I'll tell you what, the first experience that I had playing with Dave was his freshman year. He and another kid by the name of Rod Bone were freshmen, and we're going into the Southern Cal game in 1979. And, I mean, this is Charles White. They got Charles White at tailback who won the Heisman that year. Right. Marcus Allen happens to just be a lowly fullback.
They've got
five guys on the offensive line that turn out playing, in the pros. They're just Paul McDonald, the quarterback who played at Cleveland. They are absolutely loaded. And we wind up, we're with them at halftime. It might be 21 to 18, something like that at halftime. And, it so happens that Dave and Rod Bone, two freshmen, happened to be starting at cornerback that day.
Right.
We lost both of our corners, Dave Waymer, who was a senior, and John Krim, who was a sophomore at the time. Both those guys were hurt, and these guys had to come in and play. And we wound up getting beat. I think it was 42-24, maybe.
Right.
But these two guys, that was really a sign of things to come for, certainly for Dave. And Dave probably shined a little bit more than Rod at that point in time.
Right.
Dave goes on to have a great career at Notre Dame. And, they couldn't keep him out of the lineup after that.
Now, like yourself, Dave was a football, basketball, and baseball player. Were you guys buddies in college? Were you close?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. He had a different group of guys. My persona all the way through Notre Dame was I wouldn't call myself a redneck, but I was a little, I had some anger issues maybe. I had, I dealt with people a little bit differently at times than, maybe the most, a negotiating person might. We had some lines that were drawn, and ultimately, it turned out, I got to know Dave even more through Phil Carter, who was a junior co-captain with me my senior year. And, you get to know guys over a period of time and got to know Dave over those years. But certainly not at that time were we good buddies at all.
Now, one of the reasons I wanted to ask you about Dave, not just because you played in college with him and he is a known NFL, star, and even after he won with the Bears, he came to New York, and with the Giants, he won a Super Bowl in 1990.
Absolutely.
But he died 4 years ago at the age of 50, and we know he donated his brain to science, and it was confirmed that he suffered from CTE. And being that you were a high school football coach, and so was I, I always got conflicted. Because, and we talked about this a little bit, but we didn't get into it. You talked about the moms and all that. But, I was a big proponent of, the way I grew up playing, the way I was taught. So, I was the kind of coach that wanted to do the Oklahoma drill and the Nutcracker.
Absolutely.
And everything was kind of like, you were fortunate if you did that once during 2 days. And, but yet when I had a kid come over and say, hey, coach, I feel off. I feel a little lightheaded. I'm dizzy. I would always take him right out. Because it was different. We had a trainer, so I'd be like, no, come out, go see the trainer. When we were in high school, you're lucky if the coach had an orange first aid kit, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you remember that, don't you?
And you could pop those little ice packs maybe if he decided to give you one, But usually it was like, you're fine, get back in there.
And nobody taught her that stuff back then.
So in terms of that, how did you feel when you were coaching, like having to, ride the fence on that?
Well, yeah, when we used to talk, and I'm sure you did as well, Derek, there's a difference between being hurt and being injured, okay? Being hurt, you might have a scratch, you might have you may have jammed your finger, can you play with that? Hey, some people are going to have to go, and they're going to have to get a splint on their hand, whatever they need, but that was something that I always looked at and said, yeah, I could play with that. I still have a crooked finger today because I've got no ligaments left in my baby finger.
Right.
So, but once you've got to make a determination as a coach, and you got to err on the side of caution now because of so many of, whether it be the lawsuits, whether it be the kid's health, because ultimately that's all we're worried about is making sure the kid's safe and healthy.
Right.
So, you err on that side, but that's where the trainers come in. That's why trainers have become so important to the game. You just, I would say, hey, let's get this checked out. You go with the trainer. They have the concussion protocol now. They have all that. And they were starting that when I was coaching, where they had to do a baseline test on all the kids with all the concussion stuff, and I don't even remember. They made me go through it at one point. And, it's a five-minute test. And if something happens where a kid gets his bell rung, I remember getting my bell rung where I wasn't sure where I was at.
Yeah.
And guess what? I'm still on the football field.
No, I went through that too.
Yeah. You didn't want to leave because you were afraid.
Right.
That the guy behind you was gonna play and play well.
No, I was like you, Bob. That's why I looked forward when my producer said, "Hey, you want to interview Bob Crable?" I'm like, "Of course." I played linebacker. I loved and don't get me wrong, I love defense a hell of a lot more than offense because I wasn't playing running back or quarterback or receiver. But unlike you, and I didn't get offended, I understand where you're coming from. I did love defense. I was a linebacker. I used to tape up my fingers like Mike Singletary. He was my favorite linebacker growing up.
Yeah.
But I played center also. So, for my father, I was almost like from the Chuck Bednarik school of football. I never came off the field except for maybe like on punt or kickoff, and that was it.
Right.
I didn't mind playing center. But
well, and that's the thing. When I was a freshman,
they
played. The reason they wanted to move me to offense is because I played guard and linebacker. So they, and I told them, I said, hey, if you want to play me at both, that's okay. But I said, I got to play defense. I need to hit people.
No, I was like that too. If it came down to it, I certainly wanted to do the hitting instead of getting hit. That's for sure.
Amen.
And I'm with you with the coaching. A lot of kids like the manner in which I operated, but I think I was along your lines. But I did always err on the side of caution and send them to the trainer. But then a lot of kids would ask me, "Hey, Coach Waz, is he hurt?" And sometimes my response was, "Yeah, his feelings were hurt." You know, because sometimes guys were just embarrassed from getting knocked on their butt, and they said they were.
Absolutely.
You know. So I understood the difference between being injured and being hurt. And, you know, a lot of guys were like, Coach Waz said his feelings are hurt. That's about it. And, you know, they'd be back in there. You know, you got to boost their confidence. But sometimes you got to let them know, you know, you can't shy away from being embarrassed. You got to, you know, use it as adrenaline and motivation.
Amen.
So
kids eventually understand that.
Right.
A lot of times, like I said, I don't want to offend any of the moms out there, but the issues, the kid issues usually that were brought to me by moms.
Right.
And I understand that completely. You know, they carry these boys for 9 months. And I'll tell you, the worst experience I had, and I'm glad you're in New York and my wife's not hearing this, but my wife, when I was the head coach, I had my son, who was a junior, was an offensive lineman.
Right.
And he wasn't playing. And she came home one day and she said, "Don't you think all the crap that your son has to take because you're the head coach, don't you think he deserves to be on the field a little bit more?" And I looked at her and I said, "No." Oh, my goodness. She could have torn my throat out right there.
That's so, okay.
But no, that's, hey, kids earn it. Kids earn it. And, you know, if you develop a reputation where kids aren't involved in earning what it is that they do on the field, then the kids lose respect for you.
Yep, no, I agree with that. All right, so now when you come out of college, two-time All-American, you're drafted in the first round by the New York Jets in 1982.
Right.
You come to the NFL, and you're introduced to the league with a strike. You finished your career in another strike here, but when you come in 1982, how was that transition where the league started out, you know, in a lockout? So talk about your rookie year in the NFL in 1982.
Well, actually, for me, it probably wound up being, in terms of a transition, it turned out being something that benefited me, and benefited me from a standpoint of a couple things. I start the second game of my career in New York.
Right.
Greg Buttle hurt his hand, and to this day he still doesn't forgive me for this. I had nothing to do with it. But you know, Greg, he's never had an opinion or anything.
No, he's a character. He's a character for sure. Yeah.
Oh, he is. He is. But anyway, he's got a bad hand, and I'm not sure what was wrong with it. But they were going to tape it up. They shot him up. They put Novocaine in his hand, and he was going to play. So they shot him up. He tapes it up. He comes out for warm-ups, and you know, and I'm in his position. He says, "Hey, get out of my position." And they came and they said, "Crabe will get in there." And Butt sat that day, and he was so, you know, like I said, to this day, you know, he'll curse me out because he's still mad because he didn't get to play that game against the Patriots.
23 years ago, huh?
That's exactly right. But I play that game, have a
would
be a great game. I think that, you know, I played an outside linebacker position instead of inside, and now I think they realize that I have the ability to not just play the middle, but I can play the outside as well, and it made me a little bit more flexible. So, you know, throughout that, once that game came, okay, we're in a position where we strike.
Yep.
Okay, and I can't, what was it, seven games, something like that.
It was 2 full months. I mean, you guys played 2 regular season games, and then you were out till late November, maybe around Thanksgiving, right?
Right.
And we had, I'll tell you what, Lance Mell, who is still a dear friend, Lance Mell took me under his wing, and basically, you know, the only reason I was ever accepted, you know, obviously as a rookie by any of those guys, was because Lance kind of greased the skids for me, so to speak. He, you know, he had me around. They, you know, when they dogged me, he'd look at me and say, "Hey, you got to let that go, man. Don't even worry about it." So he was just, he made my experience, my rookie experience, probably the least painful as I could have expected. And, you know, we wound up having a great group of linebackers. We did everything together from, you know, ate lunch and went to lunch and, you know, to dinners and the wives got together. There was such a camaraderie within that group of linebackers. And you know what's really interesting is all those defensive guys. You're talking about the sack exchange, and you know we had some pretty good guys in the secondary as well.
Yep.
Those guys were kind of, I don't know if jealous was the right word, but we had something very unique. And I'll tell you what, Greg Buddle was probably the reason for it. We would be in meetings where we'd have meetings on our own. And we'd go through tendencies. We'd look at different things. We watched film. We would. It was a neat experience for me down the road because a lot of what I learned coaching wise took place in those meetings that we had just as linebackers.
Right.
You know, just hey, what are we going to look at? What are the keys that we can get? What are the tendencies? All those things we talked about before. You know, there wasn't a lot of that that went on in the league at that point. If you were smart enough to recognize it, you implemented it into what you did. And Butts is a pretty smart cookie. I'll hate to admit that, but
that's okay. Make you feel good, though, right?
Make sure he doesn't hear this.
Yeah, you know, I was actually a big Lance Mel guy. I was a big Mo Lewis guy later on. I thought Mel was one of the better all-around linebackers. That the Jets had run and pass defense. I almost looked at him Jack Lambert, I always thought stuff in the run. You're a big Jack Lambert guy with the Steelers.
Right.
But Jack Ham, to me, played a little more of the all-around at the outside backer spot. Did you look at – was Lance Mel the brains on the field for the defense, or was there someone else that really, you know, dissected and knew everything?
What started out, Butch was the first one. Eric, what's really hard about this for me is all these guys are Penn State guys.
Right. Penn State linebackers. Yeah. Like a football factory there with linebackers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But our coach at the time was Ralph Baker. Ralph was also a Penn State guy. So we had Ron Crosby, who was a Penn State guy. And we just, you know, myself, John Woodring, some of the other guys.
So you're saying you're a little leery of these guys, are you? Huh? No favoritism, you're thinking?
We had to tolerate it. You know, they told us how stupid we were. They told us, you know, how we didn't know how to play, how we didn't know technique, the whole deal. But Butch was probably the first one that I think was really the strong leader.
Okay.
Once Butch left, Bud Crosby or Bud Carson came in, and Bud made Lance step up. And Lance was incredibly intelligent, incredibly intelligent. And he taught me quite a bit about reading coverages. I'm sorry, reading pass plays. And once again, you're always learning. And as long as you continue to understand that you're going to be learning through that process, you got a chance.
Right.
And we continued to do some of the things that Butts implemented when he was there. And Lance very much became the leader.
You know what, I was a young Jet fan. Me and my dad really got me hooked on the Jets, and we sat down, watched all these games. And that 82 season was the first time that the Jets had won a playoff game. Since I was born, in 69, so obviously they won the Super Bowl a month before I was born. I'm always reminded of that. And then, so now, finally, they made the playoffs in 81 before when you were a senior at Notre Dame. They lost to the Bills in the playoffs, but that's when the whole sack exchange thing was born, you know, with Klecko and Gastineau assaulting quarterbacks.
Absolutely.
But I associated with the whole defense, just like, you know, the Steelers me and you, we think of the linebackers first, but the steel curtain really refers to, you know, what was going on at the line of scrimmage, stuff the gaps and let these guys clean up the mess. So they beat the Bengals. I remember they blew them out, and Darryl Ray had a big interception, returned like 100 yards. But the reason I brought up and asked you about Lance Mell was because against the Raiders, who I hate with a passion because of my father, he had two interceptions that game, huge interceptions of Jim Plunkett, and that was probably arguably the greatest playoff win. It's one. It's right up there. I know everyone thinks more modern, like recent playoff games that they've won, but I'm telling you, as a young kid, and the Bengal victory was great, but that victory out in L.A., can you speak a little bit about that? Because to me, that is probably one of the one or two best playoff wins I've seen post-Super Bowl.
Playoff wins. You know what? The whole deal with what's really interesting, the Bengal win, okay, was they took Stan Blanka, and I replaced Stan that game. That was from the Patriot game before the strike until that playoff game. I wasn't involved in the starting lineup at all.
You just rotated in?
Yeah. I was taking some snaps here and there.
Right, I got you.
But I was placed in the middle. That's the first time I played middle linebacker. Stan Blanka was our middle linebacker that year.
Right.
And Stan did a great job. And, you know, obviously he was probably probably stronger of a run force guy than I was.
Right.
But, you know, they had a spread offense that they had put in. And, you know, we went and we had a great defensive strategy. Like you said, Darryl Ray ran back at that 100-yard interception. I think it was 98 yards, actually.
Yeah, it was amazing. To me, it put the game away. I was like, that's it.
Absolutely. Well, and then you look at the offensive side of the ball. Freeman has 200-plus yards.
Right.
And things were rolling. Things were rolling. So we go out to L.A. to play the Raiders out there, and and Stan's back in there. I thought, you know, hey, great, I'm back in. Well, you know what? They got some nasty guys over there on that Raiders side, and Stan probably was a little bit more nasty at the time than I was in terms of being more seasoned and dealing with some of the shenanigans that went on with those guys.
Right.
But we played a solid game. Offense, you know, once again did some good things. But we're coming to the end of the game, and those, if I'm not mistaken, both those situations were nickel situations, where Greg Buddle was at one linebacker, Lance was at the other. And like I said, Lance is one of those guys who taught me how to read plays, how to read pass routes, you know, and what combinations exist together. And, you know, that was a perfect demonstration of how well he knew it, because he picks off those two passes, and Lance is, what's really crazy about Lance, Lance ran about a 5.40. I don't think he ever ran a sub 5.40.
That's okay. I was slow too, man. That's all right. As long as you move quick at the snap, then you're fine.
But it wasn't even moving quick. It was anticipating. His anticipation skills were as good as anyone I've ever been around in my life, and he was always in the right place at the right time, and as a matter of fact, I think that was the year that he made it to the Pro Bowl.
I tell you what, he had a great season, and from there on, he was, until he got hurt in 1986 and his career ended, he was a stud linebacker all around. And I just remember those two big playoff wins, because I remember my dad talking about Kenny Anderson with the Bengals, and he was, for the time in the NFL, he was a very high efficient, you know, you look at quarterback rating, he was a very efficient quarterback, and yet the Jets picked him off three times, and then they picked Plunkett off three times, and Oakland had just moved to L.A. They were the L.A. Raiders that year, and they were supposed to win it all. And so to go in there and beat them.
Well, if you remember that game, that was the game that Lyle Alzado ripped off Chris Ward's helmet.
Right.
And threw it at him.
Yeah.
That was, and I don't know if you remember, but, you know, God rest his soul, he actually, when it came down, he had the brain cancer and all that, he made the statement that that was part of his roid rage.
Right.
You know, those guys were all juicing it up.
Right.
And, you know, but that's, and if you would have seen his eyes, I mean, his eyes were demonic. I mean, they were, he was, there's no doubt he was on something. And I had a buddy, a guy I remember, Steve Sylvester, who's a Notre Dame guy as well. He was playing with the Raiders at that time. And he used to, we'd work out in the off season together. And he'd say, Bobby, I just stay away from those guys. He says, those guys are absolutely nuts. And they were. They were some real, let's call them characters and leave it at that. Right?
Alzado was one of those guys. You know, he was on the Raiders, so their fans loved him, and he was against my Jets, so I hated him with a passion. Did that moment with him ripping the helmet off, did that ignite you guys further in terms of bearing down and, you know, making the tackles and making the blocks and just getting it done? I know Wesley Walker got juiced up by, because he had a big, big-time reception down the stretch in that
absolutely.
Game, and he had a big game in general.
Right. And you know what? Hey, when you're at that level, you know, you're talking about, you know, getting ready to go to the AFC Championship game. This is a divisional playoff game. And those guys, you know, those guys had been there. You know, we're still trying to find our respect,
right,
you know, within where we are and our evolution. And I was, like you said, I wasn't there the year before, so I wasn't there for that Buffalo loss. I remember watching it on TV, but, you know, wasn't there for the Buffalo loss, and these guys were, they were hungry. And I'm not talking about just Lance and Greg, and I'm talking about, you know, Klecko and Gastineau and Marty Lyons.
Oh, yeah.
Those guys wanted it. And I didn't know where they were until after we got beat by Miami.
Right.
And then we're looking at it and saying, okay, how we find out how to get here next year. So, yeah, it was certainly an experience.
Yeah, you know, after beating the Raiders the way you did, me and my dad, we thought you guys were definitely going to beat the Dolphins. I know the whole thing went on with Shula and,
right,
you know, not covering the turf. And the Jets had a great
right.
rushing attack from McNeil. He might have led the league in rushing in a strike-shortened year. I mean, that's how good a running game
right.
the Jets had.
It
didn't end. Actually, you know, the Jets handled the Miami easily today over in London. And I'm not trying to make you feel bad, but you guys actually lost the first seven games you played against the Dolphins. The Jets lost every one of them.
That's
so
right.
We're not going to end the interview on that note. I'm going to take a quick break. Can you stick with us through one more commercial?
Absolutely.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about the rest of your Jet career and a couple other big seasons, most notably my favorite era, the 85-86 Jets. So, folks, Bob Crable's good enough to spend more than an hour with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about those big-time Jet teams of 85 and 86. Back after this.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.